Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning and welcome to NPR News. I'm Ewan Kerr, sitting in for Kerry Miller. Later in this hour, we will have my conversation with author Kent Nerburn. He's most famous for his book Neither Wolf Nor Dog. He's had a long career as a sculptor, writer, and a teacher, and he's combined the lessons and experiences from that life to write Dancing with the Gods, Reflections on Art and Life. But first, is someone watching your every move? Do you have a spy in your pocket? A recent article in the New York Times under the headline "Your apps know where you were last night and they're not keeping it secret" raised some alarming questions. The piece reported how the location tracking devices and smartphones are gathering information about their owners' movements. The piece went on to say that the information is then sold without that person's knowledge through multiple apps on the phone. It's just the latest concern about privacy in the digital age, and again, some members of Congress are calling for legislation to protect consumer rights. We'd like to hear your thoughts and concerns on this. What precautions do you take to preserve your privacy? What do you think the government should do, if anything? Give us a call, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, or call toll-free 800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. Joining us is one of the authors of that New York Times article, Natasha Singer. She's a technology reporter at the New York Times who covers consumer privacy. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're also joined by Sasha Meinrath. He's chair in telecommunications and director of the X Lab at Penn State. The X Lab is a think tank focusing on the intersection of technology and public policy. Good morning to you, Sasha.
Good morning.
Natasha Singer, give us details about what you and your colleagues at the Times found when you dived into who and what is being tracked by the apps on our phones.
We found that when you enable location services on your phone, so say you want to get local weather or local sports news or you want to track your fitness runs, you are enabling this entire ecosystem behind the scenes that is collecting your very specific whereabouts very frequently and sharing it. We found more than 75 companies that either share or sell or analyze and collect people's location data. And so that means hundreds of millions of phones. And we found that it's incredibly specific, that you can follow somebody 14,000 times over a day. And that means that, like, you can be tracked to your church or your mosque or your synagogue or your doctor's office or your child's school or the gym, or that you've been sitting at home and they know you're a couch potato. And it's much more intimate, pervasive, and it spreads much further than even we imagined when we started reporting this story.
Now, I understand that the pitch is that this is all done anonymously. You can't really tell who is doing what, but you find that's not true.
So the industry says it's anonymous, and what they mean by that is it is not necessarily tied to your real name, your real phone number. However, you get a unique ID number that's used to track you pervasively. And we found, because my colleague Jennifer DeVries was able to get an industry data set, and we asked for volunteers, and so a couple of people volunteered, and we were able to, because they told us their home address, actually unmask them in this data set and follow them around. And one was a teacher in upstate New York, and we could see, and, you know, we showed her data. She agreed to participate. You know, we could see her in her classroom, and her location was recorded 800 times at school, and, like, her classroom's on the side of the building, so it knew she was on that side of the building. And then she went hiking with her dog, and you could see that even in remote areas she was tracked. And she went to Weight Watchers, and we could see that. And she went to a dermatologist's office, and we could even see from the data how much time she spent there. And so we found that there's a huge gap between what consumers think is happening when they enable location services on their phone and the frequency with which their location data is collected and the vast spread of it to dozens of companies they've never heard of.
So how exactly is this information being used or monetized, to use that very popular phrase?
There are several ways it's being used. One is for marketing. So you can be categorized and marketed to based on the places you are or have been. So in some ways, that means like you're in a mall and your location is broadcast, and then, you know, stores in the mall, Starbucks or Subway, might show you an ad for a coupon at something near you. Also, you're tracked over time. So, for example, IBM owns the Weather Channel app, and basically it they work with a company that categorizes you, and so, like, the company will say, IBM, these are the people who recently visited a car lot. And so they're in market for a car, but it's much more specific because they can say, these are the people interested in a Ford, and these are the people interested in a Mazda, and these are the people who are interested in a Taurus or whatever. It's also used to figure out foot traffic. So retailers get the data, and they can see, you know, what kind of people are in their stores, what kind of people are in their competitor stores. You can use it to figure out where you might want to put your next store or restaurant because of foot traffic, but it's also being sold to hedge funds and other financial institutions to predict the short-term earnings of companies, because you can tell, are there more phones at a factory? It means production is up. Or are there, like, fewer phones at a store? It means sales are down. And so some financial services are buying people's location data to try to predict earnings for different companies.
And I want to get to Sasha to get his thoughts on the public policy implications of this. But we actually have a call from Jan in St. Cloud, who has both a question and I think an experience. Good morning, Jan. Tell us about what happened with you.
Yeah, good morning. I live in Minnesota, and my son lives in Arizona. And we weren't texting. We were actually talking on the phone. And I was saying things to him, you know, like a mom says to a son. I'm trying to, like, pump him up about the job hunt he's on. And literally the next day on my Facebook feed came an advertisement from a jewelry company for a pendant. And on the pendant that you were suggesting that I buy for my son literally had exact phrases from the conversations I had with him on the phone.
That
was creepy.
I bet. But, I mean, could this just have been a coincidence, do you think?
There's no way. Do you think that's possible, that somebody's listening, not just looking at where I'm at?
Well, let's ask our guests. Natasha, Sasha, what do you think?
Well, we hear this periodically, and journalists have looked into it, and we have not found that apps or phones are listening to you and translating what they hear into marketing pitches. However, some televisions do have sound-enabled and can do that. So we haven't, you know, found a causal link, but it could also be, you know, things that if you're connected to your son on Facebook and other comments that were made, that there were inferences made. So I'm not saying it's technically not possible. I'm just saying journalists have looked into it, and we haven't been able to prove that this is true.
Let me turn to you, Sasha Meinrath. You study how new technologies are being used and the possible public policy implications. I mean, how much of a surprise was this New York Times article to you about the amount of tracking that is going on?
I view the New York Times article and all of the work that journalists are doing to investigate this phenomenon as incredibly, incredibly important. It points to just the numerous and growing facets in places where our data is being collected, commercialized, shared. But it also illuminates just that this is all the tip of the iceberg. The knowns are very small. And I think, as Jan's question really drives home, we don't know the extent to which data flows are happening, that data is being shared. We don't know for certain that there wasn't, say, an assistant that was running during that phone call, picking up that information and translating it into advertising. And what this all underscores is that the lay of the land, the rule of law, the consumer protections that we have in this country haven't been updated in a generation. And most of them predate the advent of the internet, much less smartphones and all of these devices and the Internet of Things and these helpers. And what ends up happening is that we've created sort of this digital Wild West where companies have determined that if they can do something that makes them a buck, they will. And that is regardless of the detrimental impacts that might accrue to us, the end users, the citizenry of the U.S. And so even though we have the potential for technologies to be incredibly helpful, incredibly liberatory, the trajectory we're also on is rather dystopian, where our privacy is being invaded in ways that we may not even know about, and where our every thought, word, and deed is being recorded for purposes known, but also for purposes that we haven't yet discovered.
You know, I think that early on, people were they were aware that there was a chance that there was stuff being tracked, but they were prepared to kind of trade the fact that they might get the occasional ad if they could get an app that really helped them get through traffic because of kind of the crowdsourced information that was coming through those, or that they could find out whether their nearest favorite restaurant was, things like that. But the balance really does seem to have shifted, but the public awareness mm-hmm. perhaps has not.
Well, what we were promised was that all of this data collection would lead to a better experience, right? Your ads would be targeted. You would be surrounded by the information you need, you know, that this would be helpful to you. What we weren't told is that, in fact, we were making this Faustian bargain, a deal with the devil in some ways, where, you know, discrimination, algorithmic or outright, would be baked into a lot of these systems. So what we weren't told is that, you know, women would be shown ads for lower paying jobs than men. What we weren't told is that if you were using, say, Orbitz on a Mac, you would be shown higher prices than if you were using a PC. And that these forms of discrimination were hidden, but they were all part of a business model that was trying to maximize profit regardless of the collateral damage.
Natasha Singer, you showed some people who agreed to share their phone information with you exactly what they had been – how they had been tracked. And, I mean, how disturbed were they when they saw this?
They were very disturbed because they had actually looked into which apps they were giving location permission to. And, you know, when you have an app and it asks for location permission, it says things like, you know, your location will be used to give you better directions or, you know, better track your fitness run or whatever. And so they thought they knew what was happening to their data. And one of the people who agreed to volunteer to be located in this location data set we found was a nurse at a big New York hospital. And we showed her that her phone was tracked even in the operating room. And so she was worried about her privacy, the privacy of her patients, and she went back to all the other nurses in her department and said, show me your phone. And she was like, turn that off, delete that. And so Sasha is right. We do not have a federal consumer data privacy law that gives us very many rights to this, but we do have a law that prohibits deceptive business practices. And so one of the arguments that privacy advocates and law professors are making is that this wholesale collection and surveillance of consumer data, when the consumer actually isn't aware of what they're agreeing to, because you said there's a bargain and we agreed to it, I think people agreed to it, but they didn't understand what was being collected and what was being done with the data, and as Sasha said, how that data could be weaponized against them. So even without a privacy law, and in January, Congress will take up the idea of doing a big consumer privacy bill. But even without that, the question is whether a number of these apps and companies are deceiving consumers by not actually being transparent about what they're doing with the data.
We are talking about digital privacy rights this hour. My guests are Natasha Singer, who is a technology reporter at the New York Times, who covers consumer policy, and Sasha Meinrath, who is the chair in telecommunications and director of the X Lab at Penn State, which focuses on the intersection of technology and public policy. We want to hear from you too. Call us at 651-227-6000 or toll free 1-800-242-2828. We have Dave on the line from Excelsior. Dave, you had a comment.
Actually, it's Dick.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That is fine. Yes, I personally think the solution to this is quite simple and not as costly as most people believe. You know, if we followed European privacy laws and passed something quite comparable to them, the software and everything has already been rewritten because many of these large software companies want to be compliant in Europe. And, you know, and then they abuse the situation here. The other aspect of this is that personal privacy and invasion of personal privacy actually is a national security problem. Because if we have key people who are involved with secret and confidential information from a government standpoint, if their personal information is being tracked, that puts them at risk. So there's a couple aspects to it. One is passing a law to make it simple and just getting it done, and it will be full compliance. It won't be costly. And secondly, recognizing that there's a national security threat to what's going on as well.
Natasha, do you have any thoughts on that?
So it was a really interesting point about the security concerns, because in the data set we got of more than a million consumers' phones, we could see that phones were tracked at nuclear power plants and military academies and police stations and government offices, and we tracked the folks who traveled with a mayor on the course of a day. So Dick is right that the collection of personal data of people who work in sensitive locations is vulnerable both to hacking and misuse by the companies. And the second point Dick raised, which was the Europeans have a tough new privacy law, and it gives them many more rights to know what's happening to their data, to see it, and to control it than Americans have. And the Europeans have declared that privacy and data protection is a fundamental human right. And we have not done that in the United States.
Well,
to add to that, I would just say, you know, the General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR, which is what EU has passed, is a great leap forward. It's necessary, but it's also insufficient. There's tremendous array of loopholes and kind of caveats built into that. So whereas it is a wonderful thing to have that baseline, it's also the case that it doesn't go nearly far enough to empowering users to have real control over our data. And in terms of the national security concerns, I want to drive home with a very concrete example that happened just this year, which is that Strava, which is one of these fitness tracker kind of watch devices, put up a bunch of public maps that included maps, literally, of secret military bases in theater of operations in war zones. And so accidentally, through this kind of geolocational tracking, we were exposing publicly the exact locations of secret military bases and putting soldiers in harm's way. So it is not at all hyperbole to be pointing out that this tracking has some fundamental like security concerns, as well as affecting the everyday lives of citizens across the United States.
Just to go back very briefly to the European law, I mean, I think a lot of people here experienced when that law went into effect, we suddenly saw a lot of our apps asking for permissions and letting people know what was going on, because these were, you know, international companies that were covering everything. And so we saw covering everything, every place where they're actually active. So we saw these a lot. Do you think those warnings got people here thinking at all, or was it just an annoyance?
I definitely think it was an annoyance, which is to say that just the beginning of the disclosure of how many different ways were being tracked, there were so many it became annoying to have to acknowledge all of them. And the reality is also that simply by kind of making that transparent, it gave a window into sort of the sheer scale of this. but there wasn't any meaningful way to opt out. Right? There was no way for me to tell this service or application, like, ah, I see you're tracking this information. I don't want you to, but I still want to use the app. And so right. into the space, you're basically told either opt in or drop out, like completely. You can't use all of these services and applications. And that is a very unfair decision to foist upon folks that often have been using these applications for months or years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's and really, this is smartphones have become a vital tool for many people. That you have to have them in your private life, but also quite often it's kind of required for work too. And so you're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place.
That's right. And the phones, the ways in which they're tracking us, it's not just the phone itself. It's the services and applications you're running on the phone. It's Bluetooth devices that come within range of your phone. It's Wi-Fi hotspots that you might connect to with your phone. It's the cell towers that the phone uses. Like, there's so many different layers of data collection, geolocational data collection, that honestly, there's no meaningful way to opt out. Hmm. Even if you click all the boxes and say, you know, don't track this, don't track that, don't track anything, you're still going to be tracked.
We have a lot of people on the line and all with individual experiences about what has happened to them. So I'm going to quickly spin through some of them, if I may. Nate is on the line from Shakopee. Good morning, Nate.
Hi. So I just wanted to say that I use Snapchat on a daily basis. And when I close out of the app, not like turn it off, I'll get notifications sometimes saying that it's using my camera. And it's creepy because you can't really turn the camera off on Snapchat. And that's the only app that I use to talk to some people. So if I get rid of Snapchat, those people are kind of locked off from communication. But at the same time, I don't want them recording my face or using my camera, you know?
Wow, I mean, have you ever thought about you may just drop it? You may just get rid of Snapchat?
I don't think so. That's the frustrating thing because it's, like I said, there are a good amount of people that I just talk to on there. So if I get rid of it, I just don't talk to those people anymore. Like, I don't really text anyone. And, yeah. Well. And like I said, you can't really... It's kind of hard to turn off the camera for that because it's one of the forms of communication that you use.
Well, thank you. Thank you for telling us about that. Let's turn to Chloe in Rochester. Good morning, Chloe.
Hi, how's it going?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing good. Pretty much my story is I've been really aware of this for a long time. I don't like what smartphones are doing to people in general, but especially the marketing aspect. And so when I got a smartphone, I purposely did not get data. And so I only have internet when I can use the Wi-Fi. That's the only time I have maps, anything like that. And so I was in Alaska this summer working on commercial fishing boats. And the way I got all my jobs was by walking the docks. So nothing was recorded online. No one knew on Facebook. I rarely talked about it on the phone because I was busy. But what I did talk about a lot face to face with people was tying knots. And I got really obsessed with this idea of tying the perfect bowline knot. And about like 2 weeks later, I went online and I think it was just like on Facebook, you know, the ads on the side was just like bombarded with knot tying fishermen's books. And it kind of blew my mind because I had no Wi-Fi turned on those whole 2 weeks and I had no apps running that should have been tracking anything.
I'm kind of amazed that there are books out there buying ads. But it must have been disconcerting.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Let me very quickly turn to Ralph from St. Paul. Good morning, Ralph. You have a recommendation.
I've been very concerned about privacy from the. Oh, and thanks for taking my call, by the way.
You're welcome.
I've been very concerned about privacy online and also with my phone. And so, it turns out that you know, if you use Safari on the iPhone, of course, Safari tracks you. And so I just don't use it. Instead, I use a browser called Ghostry. Ghostry doesn't track you, and it also blocks trackers on websites. So it basically reduces the amount of tracking you have online. On the desktop, it's available as a plugin to like Firefox or something like that. And the way you see it operating is you don't see ads on websites.
And that must be great. But, well, thank you. Thank you. Sasha, it sounds like you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are a number of services, applications that help alleviate this problem. The ad blockers or AdBlock Plus is a great one. Ghostry is a great one for browsing. Privacy Guard is one that you can put onto your cell phone itself to help address that issue that Nate was talking about wanting, you know, when he's not using the application to actually block camera access. The reality, though, is that these are kind of like kludges that we use because we are, as consumers, are not empowered to have control over the devices, services, and applications we use. That, in fact, we are forced in many ways to use a phone that may track various information, may track information that we plug into a web browser and then serve us ads, as happened with Chloe, that even when we're not online, our phones may store this information and upload it when you go to a hotspot. And these are all kind of a symptomology of the lack of meaningful protection and empowerment that consumers face in these digital realms.
It sounds as though we may be getting some legislation about this out of Congress, but we're also in recent hearings about digital privacy on the Hill, it's not been entirely convincing that the people actually, the members of Congress, know what they're talking about. I mean, maybe I should start with you, Natasha. I mean, what are you expecting will be coming out of Washington on this issue?
There is a huge interest now in finding some way to regulate the tech giants. And it started, as you know, with Cambridge Analytica, the voter profiling company that ended up with data on millions and millions of Facebook users. And then we got into election interference and how the Russians targeted ads with disinformation based on people's data. And so we have huge issues that were caused by all this data collection. And there is an interest in finding a way to give consumers some rights to know what data is being collected about them and also to have some control. But we also see that California passed a pretty tough privacy law, and there's a huge movement among the tech industry to try to get Congress to pass a federal law to nullify the California law and have weaker protections for consumers federally.
I loved a line that you wrote in one of your pieces about the recent congressional hearings. That's the quote is, asking companies whose business models revolve around exploiting data-based consumer influence techniques to explain their privacy policies seems about as useful as asking sharks to hold forth on veganism. I mean, this sounds like it's going to be an uphill battle.
I think it is. I think that, you know, the companies... Sorry.
So maybe I should ask Sasha. But I mean, what?
Sure.
Is this? Do you have any confidence that we're going to see meaningful legislation on this?
I mean, a lot depends on which factions carry the day. One of the hats I wear is as president of the Fourth Amendment Advisory Committee, which works with the Fourth Amendment Caucus, which are kind of a more tech-savvy group of libertarian right, progressive left congressional members looking into a lot of these complex questions and trying to figure out what actually needs to take place to protect not just consumers but actually protect the Fourth Amendment, right? That one of the things that, again, is sort of left unexplored is that in the 5 years since Edward Snowden kind of let us all know about the extent of surveillance in the United States, that surveillance has increased and that places where standard business practices of sharing information with the NSA were found to have been illegal, congressional action retroactively granted immunity to those companies. So what we're actually currently on is kind of a five-year trajectory of things getting worse, of consumers having fewer rights and protections over their data, not more. And into that space, the question is, can we turn the tide? Can we actually start implementing solutions that place our not just rights, but our constitutionally guaranteed privacy rights, our Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, our First Amendment right to freedom of speech and assembly, like to place our rights foremost in these kinds of legislative actions. And that is still, in my mind, to be determined. That, in essence, there is a pitched battle being waged within Congress between forces that are really, it seems, more interested in protecting economic profit-making motives and those that are looking at our privacy rights, our constitutional rights, as more important. And we'll have to wait and see what happens. A lot will be determined by the committees and the committee structures that will be set, I guess, when the new Congress is seated on January 3rd.
We're running a little short on time here, but I know that there's probably a lot of people are listening to us now thinking, well, it's going to be a while until there's a law passed. What should I be doing now? What practical steps can I take as someone who has one of these devices in my pocket? What should I be doing on a regular basis to protect my privacy? Could we start with you, Natasha? I mean, what do you recommend?
So I'm glad you brought that up because Nate had called in and talked about Snapchat. Mm. And what I wanted to say to him and everybody else is, whether you have an Android phone or an iPhone, you can go to settings and look at each app and see what they can track. And so if there are apps you're not using anymore, delete them from your phone because that will have them stop them tracking you. And go through the other ones, and if devices don't need your location, turn them off. And in the case of Snapchat, you can turn off the camera from your settings and turn it back on when you're using the app. I get that that's annoying if you're using Snapchat all day long, but you are actually able to turn off certain permissions. This is not perfect. There are many other ways that you're being tracked online, your mobile phone carrier, but you can do something to limit some of the tracking.
Sasha?
I would simply underscore that, which is to say that, you know, if you do go and do some basic web searches for personal privacy, I know the Electronic Frontier Foundation has a number of resources that just kind of walk you through some of the more usable services and applications that are out there to help take back your privacy. And the end result of all of that is going to be that will be necessary but insufficient to protecting your personal privacy. This really does need an update to our rule of law. And that really requires the involvement of all of us in pushing for the kinds of protections and privacies that civil society should have.
We received a message from Jane in St. Paul, said, you know, we're actually really paying for these supposedly free apps with our information. And mm-hmm. And that's the trade-off, that ultimately perhaps we should just bite the bullet and realize if we want this privacy, we're going to have to pay more. I mean, are we just ultimately looking at more expensive services in the future, you think? We just got about 30 seconds here.
I would say if you look within the open source community, a lot of the most privacy protective services and applications are also free. So there are options, but they don't have the huge PR and marketing campaigns behind them.
Great. Well, I'd like to thank you to both of our guests, New York Times technology reporter Natasha Singer and Sasha Meinrath, Chair in Telecommunications and Director of the X Lab at Penn State. I think we've only really scratched the surface here, and no doubt we'll be back talking about this again. Thank you very much to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!